Écoutez, c'est un grand plaisir de voir que vous êtes si nombreux. C'est la troisième fois qu'on organise ces nuits américaines pour les élections aux États-Unis. Je vois que le suspense de l'élection conduit à toujours plus de monde. Je remercie donc tous les organisateurs, le LABEX TEF6, donc Richard Reichmann en particulier, son directeur, les éditions de l'école et donc notamment Emmanuel Desvaux, leur directeur, Romain Huret pour le Centre d'études nord-américaines, Sylvain Bourmeau qui va animer la première table ronde. Et je vous souhaite une bonne soirée dans l'attente des résultats qui ne tomberont qu'après sans doute la conclusion de cette soirée, mais qui n'en sera pas moins intéressante. Bonne soirée à tous.
Merci Pierre Cyril pour ce mot d'introduction. Oui, du suspense beaucoup, une sorte de tension un petit peu sans doute pour un certain nombre, mais qui ne sera pas, qui ne disparaîtra pas avant le cœur de la nuit. Donc voilà, on se quittera avant de savoir probablement quoi que ce soit. Néanmoins, il nous a semblé intéressant de parler de cette situation qui pose des questions nouvelles s'agissant de la politique américaine et peut-être au-delà d'ailleurs de la politique américaine. On entre aussi dans une séquence électorale et la perspective comparatiste sera sûrement pertinente. On a prévu de faire ça de façon un peu improvisé et pas du tout comme un colloque. Chacun n'est pas venu avec un papier écrit. Et on va commencer par donner la parole à des amis américains qui sont à Paris en ce moment, soit qu'ils aient pris l'habitude d'y résider régulièrement chaque année pour y travailler, soit qu'ils soient de passage et qu'on les ait attrapés au vol. Alors, ceux qui ont pris l'habitude d'y travailler depuis longtemps et d'y résider, c'est d'abord Harvard, qu'on ne présente pas non plus, grand sociologue, auteur de nombreux livres classiques de la discipline et qui a l'habitude de venir passer ses automnes ici, qui est un observateur également attentif de la politique américaine. Et puis enfin, celui qui, je crois, va se présenter et se considère comme un élève de Howard Becker, mais qui est pas, même si je crois que le professeur récuse cette filiation, Fred Turner est historien de la culture. Il travaille sur les médias en particulier. Et l'un de ses livres vient juste de paraître en français, Le Cercle démocratique. Il est assez précieux pour comprendre ce qui se passe du côté du phénomène Trump. Fred est professeur à l'université de Stanford dans l'école de communication. Voilà. Alors on va commencer avec vous trois. Je ne présente pas les autres intervenants. Romain, qui me succédera, le fera. Mais on s'est dit que c'était bien de commencer avec les Américains, comme on vous a appelé. Et ils vont s'exprimer en anglais. On part du principe que tout le monde parle l'anglais. Évidemment, après, on va ouvrir le dialogue. Vous pourrez poser les questions en français, en anglais, comme vous voulez. On se débrouillera. Harold, si tu veux commencer, peut-être par nous parler de ton sentiment ce soir, de cette tension dont je parlais, de ce suspense, la manière dont tu...
Ok. When Sylvain invited me to take part in this event, I told him I didn't know anything about American politics. And I meant that seriously, because I know what it means for someone who used to work in a university to say that they know about a subject. I only know about American politics from growing up in Chicago and then living in a succession of cities that were run by Democratic machines. So I actually know nothing about all the people that you're all concerned with tonight, as I am, the ones who, heaven forbid, might vote for Donald Trump. So with that disclaimer, I don't know anything. I'm a little bit like Fred Wiseman, who, as you said in Liebig the other day, he shoots a lot of film and then he looks and sees what he found out. And I'm like that. I like to work with things that I can see in front of me. That's why I have a problem every 4 years, because nobody tells me that kind of thing. They tell me 62% of people over 60 are going to do this, and blah, blah, blah. And there's a problem with that kind of data, that kind of information, because it's not something you can see and hear. It's a sort of second or third order inference from something, but it's never clear what. And so what I'd like to tell you a little bit about tonight is the history of this phenomenon of polling, and how it looks to me we might be able to do better. You probably know that polling for about political campaigns and elections in the United States began in the 1930s with a few disastrous predictions made by various people. And then it got professionalized and was very much influenced by a Viennese refugee named Paul Lazarsfeld. Lazarsfeld had studied psychology in Vienna, and he was a mathematician, and he had learned to make questionnaires. He'd learned to do a lot of other things, but he thought when he escaped from Vienna and came to the United States that the best thing he could do would be to make questionnaires and see if somebody wanted to support that activity. And he realized very quickly that there was a problem that his questionnaires could solve. And that was the problem that people who made advertising had. The problem with advertising, and here I do speak from something I know about, because I grew up in this atmosphere. My father made advertising campaigns. That's what he did. And he told me all the terrible secrets. And the big secret is that nobody knows whether advertising accomplishes anything. So the problem for people in his business was to convince the makers and sellers of services and products that it would actually be worth them investing in advertising. There was a big problem because Milton Hershey, who was the president of the Hershey Chocolate Company, and he made Hershey bars and Hershey kisses and all kinds of chocolate candies. And Mr. Hershey did not believe in advertising. So he never spent anything on advertising. And he sold a lot of chocolate. And that was a deterrent. You know, people would look and say, well, Hershey doesn't spend any money on this. Why should I? And so the advertising professionals had to convince the people with the money that they did accomplish something. And one way to do that was to put in an intermediate step where you advertised and then you asked people to respond to the advertising in a questionnaire. There's a better way to judge the efficacy of advertising, which is sales. Did we sell more? That's a much better way. But that's complicated because you don't have the same conditions. Maybe this one day it snowed and sales were depressed because of that, or there was a strike and transportation was disrupted, or any of the things that can happen. And You could never be sure that the advertising could accomplish anything. So Lazarsfeld decided that if they asked a lot of questions about the response to advertising, they could get around that problem. They could solve that problem. And he found a willing colleague in the president of the Columbia Broadcasting System, which was one of the three major radio chains in the United States at the time. Stanton, in a way, had the same problem because some of the advertising would be on the radio, and so it was in his interest to convince people with money that this worked. And so they began selling that idea. How did they convince people that it worked? Well, they couldn't convince them by comparing sales. What they could do is point to the one case where you knew absolutely what the result of the advertising was. It was resulted from other things as well, and that was voting in an election. You get to do it once, and we count all the votes, and we see whose advertising was better. And it was a potent proof of the efficiency of advertising. There were, of course, some problems along the way, like the prediction that Thomas Dewey would beat Harry Truman in 1948, which he failed to do. And things like that. But in general, polling became accepted as a measure, and it had all the validity that goes with everybody else believes it, why don't you? So it became the standard. But to do polling all across the country is a very expensive operation, and so there are very few national polls. And the ones that are have serious flaws, and everyone knows what they are. There's a well-known list of difficulties in polling, starting with sampling. They speak now of the problem of non-response. That is, I asked this gentleman if he would like to take my survey, and he said, no, thank you, and turned around and walked away. Or I called this one, and I said, I'm making a survey, and he hung up the phone. And more people are doing that, so that I think nowadays they're lucky to have a 7 or 8% response rate, which raises the serious question of what about all those people who wouldn't answer? One solution to that has been to amalgamate all the partial surveys that are made everywhere. And that's the solution that a man named Nate Silver found. And he began doing that in the New York Times and now independently. And he's elaborated that into a very complex and probably fairly useful way of arriving at a prediction. The problem with his predictions for people who want to know what's going to happen is that they are so surrounded by cautions, possible other interpretations, etc., that by the time you read to the end of his daily column, you have no idea what's going to happen, which is why we're all here tonight. I mean, if there was a way to manipulate that data and get assurance, he certainly knows it. Is there an alternative? Paul Lazarsfeld, who I started with, did one of the very first studies of of voting. It was called a book that was published in 1948, I think. It dealt with the 1940 presidential election in the United States, and it studied voters in one county in Ohio, where the city of Sandusky it was. And they did something wonderful, which is they didn't just ask who are you going to vote for, but they asked the same people that question and many other questions over a period of months. I think they did 8 interviews each with several hundred people. Same interviewers came and interviewed you and you and you. And the wonderful thing was they didn't just read the list of questions. They got into a conversation. Now, you know, all sociology books have a section on methods of research. How did I do this? He mentioned in his discussion of methods the panel thing, interviewing the same people many times. What he didn't say was that they strayed from the questionnaire and talked a lot with everybody, had long conversations. How do I know they did that? Because the authors of the book quote extensively from these conversations. And so they were able to learn one key thing and a lot of other things. The key thing was that people don't pay much attention to the radio. That's all there was then. They don't pay much attention to the radio or the newspapers, but they do pay attention to some of their friends. And so he turned that into a concept that some people were opinion leaders. Well, that's a big step forward from polling individuals. If you begin to get a sense of a process that goes on over months, and you could see it in everything that they described in the book. Well, why doesn't everybody do that? It's so good. The material is so interesting. It's very like the film you come home with. You can see life happening. But it's expensive. To have 8 interviews done over and over again, complete with lengthy, semi-off-the-record conversations with all these people, and then those conversations written down, to do that over the whole country would be quite expensive, even if you had a good sample, however you would define that. So we're stuck. There's a problem, we know the solution, and we can't do it. Now, I just finished writing a book. Fred's going to show you his book. This book doesn't exist in physical form yet, but it will in June. And it's called Evidence. En français, on peut dire épreuve. And that's what it's about, is what kind of proof do we offer for the ideas that we present? And how dependable is it? How much does it tell us of what we should know, what we must know, in order to talk about the things we want to talk about? And the answer pretty much is we don't do that very much. What we do is pretend that what we've got is good enough. And we say, well, the mistakes and all that will be random, and so they will cancel out, which is personally, I don't believe it. And whenever anybody looks, it turns out I'm right not to believe it. Mostly people don't look. One chapter in this book deals with the thing that everybody in social science is aiming for, which is the kind of serious proof that people in the physical and biological sciences offer. And I was lucky to read a book that I recommend to you. I can't think of the name of it, but the author is Sebastian Balibar, who was a physicist not far from here, on Rue Dume, and he worked in low temperature physics, when you get temperatures down to practically 0 degrees Kelvin, like no heat at all, no molecular movement, things are different. But it's very hard to accomplish that. Balibar had a room in the sub-basement of one of the buildings there, and he had a special refrigerator built and a technician who worked on nothing but this refrigerator to make sure that it worked, and various other people. And they spent, you know, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of euros to create that temperature that was, you know, this far from 0 degrees Kelvin. All the effort went into ruling out possible sources of contamination, because something was always interfering. He was trying to get the temperature down, and then the last most exciting part of the book is he describes they're almost there, and then something happens and the temperature rises, and they discover that the music from France Culture is coming in a window somewhere, and the radio wave is sufficient to affect, and so they had to deal with that. And they did, because if he didn't deal with that, somebody else in some other part of the world would get ahead of him in the race to zero. That's what they do. And if we want to be like them, which in principle seems like a good idea, that's what we have to do. I'll end up recommending that book to you. Diane, do you remember the title of it? It's in the series called Raconter la vie that Pierre Rosenvallon edits. Okay.
Je crois qu'il y a laboratoire dans le titre, mais je ne sais plus exactement comment il s'appelle. So, I guess you could say something about what Fred Weizmann just said about propaganda and Goebbels and stupidity. Sure. And
yeah, unfortunately, Goebbels and stupidity are sort of what I do for a living. So this will be the last time you see the cover. But I have yes, thank you. It wouldn't be an American without a promotion. Thank you, Howie. That's great. Thank you. This is great. Thank you. That's great. Thanks. So I wrote a book about the 1940s and in America, and it's a book about how in the 1940s we turned against mass media because we believed that it was actually something that created fascism. We thought that Germany had gone fascist because somehow Hitler had gotten hold of radio, cinema, and the newspaper and created a kind of one-to-many broadcasting system. Goebbels was the expert. Some people in Roosevelt's circle thought we should imitate Goebbels, but fortunately a number didn't. And they decided to begin to design a wholly new kind of media. Media that would surround individuals, that would be environmental, that would have images on ceilings, walls, and floors, that would have sound coming in from all sides. And they began to try to build these multimedia environments in New York at the Museum of Modern Art and other places. And they became powerful propaganda tools during World War II. So that's all in this book. Couple of books later, a lot of my work has been tracing the rise of that form from the 40s to the present. And where it takes us in the present is to social media. And one of the things that I find most painful about Donald Trump is that he is taking advantage of media that were diversified and multiplied in the 1940s as a way to prevent fascism and putting them to work for fascist ends.
He doesn't know what the word fascist means.
Yeah, and yet he seems able to act out its core principles. It's sort of astonishing. I did a little point-by-point comparison with Mussolini's 12 core principles, and he's got 9 of them, you know? He believes in an America that was once great that he will resuscitate. He celebrates his own heterosexual masculinity as a symbol of all potency in the state. His hands are small, but he's a big man. we can go on down the list. Deeply racist, deeply xenophobic, anti-Semitic, wants Muslims to register, wear labels as Jews once did in Germany. I mean, the list goes on and on. So make no mistake, Donald Trump is an American fascist, and we've had a lot of trouble saying that word in the United States. And one of the reasons that we've had trouble saying that word is that the techniques by which he is coming to power are the very techniques of individualism and individual expression that are the basis of democracy, and very particularly the basis of the democratic or ostensibly democratic media that he's deploying. So why is that happening? I'll offer two ideas, and I don't know either. I truly don't know, and I'm intensely pained by it. And if we wake up tomorrow and Donald Trump is president, if there's any Canadians here, I'll marry you. You know? Okay? Just men, women, I'm flexible. Canada. Canada is the key point, okay? I just think I'm kidding, too. This is great. So I'll offer two explanations. One actually comes from one of my students, Daniel Kreese, who's a professor at the University of North Carolina and a brilliant one. And he points out that the American right has a long history in the United States, and he's quite right. In 1939, 22,000 Americans rallied for fascism in New York. In Madison Square Garden, they hung a banner from the ceiling that said, stop Jewish domination of Christian America. In 1939, after Hitler went into Poland, 1,000 Americans marched down East 86th Street in their own brown shirt uniforms, carrying American flags and swastikas, and they were not booed. That's America. Okay? John Birch Society has been saying save the Republic since 1955. So the right has a long tradition. What's new in our circumstance, I think, is the rise of a right-wing media industry that's able to take advantage of and accelerate, sort of pour like hydrogen on the fire that is Donald Trump's Twitter feeds. So a medium that was meant to be sort of one-to-one-to-one-to-one, many-to-many, Twitter, has ended up being an engine for accelerating high-profit, mass-mediated broadcasts that are absolutely hideous. And in this context, the search for profit and the accelerated speed at which the media industry works really undercut any need for truth. Is it a good story? That's the question. If it's not true, we'll say that later. But right now, we got to get it on the screen. That's how that world works, and it's enormously frustrating. The other thing to say is that media are not solely responsible for Donald Trump. Donald Trump, there's a lot to hold him. There's a lot to hold media to account for. Donald Trump was, as you know, a media star. He was a star of a reality show called The Apprentice, where he behaved erratically and was loved for it. On Twitter, he behaves erratically and is loved for it. And the very rational Hillary Clinton says he's irrational. And his fans say, yeah. Yeah, it's great. So that's sort of the media side. But the other side to remember, this is something about the United States that I'm not sure is visible here, or maybe it is the tremendous economic divides that have risen up in our country. If you go to Detroit, you will see a skyscraper in the middle of the city that stands completely empty with its windows smashed. It looks like a war came through that city, but it never did. If you go to Pittsburgh, you'll see a city that's recovering, but is still deeply underwater. If you go to parts of Pennsylvania where they mine coal, those folks are suffering. If you go to Ohio, their industries have gone overseas. There is a real legitimate anger in our country, and it's one that the left, of which I count myself a proud member, has discounted as somewhat ridiculous, laughable, silly. Because it's those crazy working class deplorables, as Hillary Clinton said. That's not an attitude that's going to make things better. Our challenge in the States right now, I think, is to reach across political divides, to find places where we can work with people of other classes, of other races, and do things together, in Howie's phrase. We need to do things together because doing them apart, loudly and stupidly, isn't helping.
The result of the election will come in the States, apparently, from the votes of women, if it is Hillary Clinton which is elected, apparently. Because men are in majority voting for Donald Trump, and women are in majority voting for Hillary Clinton. So my question is a bit aggressive, but why did you invite only two women?
Okay, I'm American. I live here as well. And what shocks me the most about Trump's support base is that the very people whose policies would alienate Are the people that so passionately support him? What are your thoughts about this?
This is a perfectly rational question about irrationality. But this is the challenge, right? So Trump supporters, like Peter Thiel from Silicon Valley, who's an executive there, will say things like, don't take Donald Trump literally, take him seriously. And what they mean by that is stop asking him for ideas and policies and all that rational stuff. Feel the kind of person he is. Feel his power. I mean this very literally, in the old fascist Mussolini Hitler sense. Feel the strength of the leading man and follow him. That's the logic that's in play. It's the kind, but where does that logic come from? Well, partly it comes from anger, but partly it also comes from the ways that we watch media. If you watch media, you're watching not just for reasonable ideas, even on the news. You know, I was a journalist for 10 years. We used to have a saying on TV news, which I didn't work in, I work print, in TV news, that if it bleeds, it leads. Every single night, over and over and over again, the evening news leads with car crashes. Now, if you tell me you're watching the evening news in order to learn what intersections are dangerous in your town, I will call you a liar. You are watching for that little emotional hit. It's like a drug. Donald Trump is a reality TV star. Donald Trump is an expert at delivering that hit. And at some point, it gets really tempting to make like a drug addict and just give up on reason and say, yeah, that, pass the needle, baby.
I just come back from America, and I was really concerned about how many people of my age believe in conspiracy and the popularity of website like Citizen Watch, and also what happened with Bernie Sanders, everybody thinking that Hillary is a killer, and all those kind of theory and conspiracy who are really, really strong anytime it comes to talk about politics. Yeah, and also the uneducation maybe of people. So I just had a question about why do you think those conspiracy theory are so popular? Why we were talking about statistic and questionnaire. So yeah.
Well, the easy answer is I don't know. The more difficult question to think about is how would you find out? Because that a question put that way, excuse me for disagreeing with you so grossly, but a question put that way, nobody can answer that question. There isn't a why. There's a how. How did that get to be something that people talk about and do? It's a very different question. Why asks for some underlying, hidden, we didn't know about it till now. We never knew about things like that. No, we know all about it. It's our daily life. It's what Fred Wiseman would find on film, something like that. You know, if people were doing that, because they might not be doing it at all. That's what you find out. I'm a great believer in not asking why people do things, but rather asking how did it happen that they did that? Because a lot of people do things that they have no intention of doing. They didn't have that in mind at all. They were thinking about something else, and that happened. Etc. It's not a useful question.
Hi, so actually I had a question because we were a lot discussing about the rationality of the people voting for Trump or Hillary Clinton. But one thing that I have not all the knowledge to understand is when you look at different countries, like in the 1930s, we talked about Adolf Hitler a little bit earlier, who came to power founding his own party. We can also look at France with Marine Le Pen founding her own, well, not founding her party, but being grown up in her own party. Here, Trump is part of a Republican party that existed for a while. And how did this guy come through all the filters, although I'm not for an holistic society neither, but this guy made its way to this election, and that's my big question. What your thoughts are about that?
So, It's a really interesting question. So Trump's relationship to the Republican Party is a limited one. He isn't, you know, as you've seen in the coverage, the Republican Party stalwarts have walked away from him. Funders have abandoned him. Leaders have been very ambivalent in supporting him when they've supported him at all. They've sort of said, I support him, but I don't, you know, that kind of thing, right? What Trump did, to everyone's surprise, was he mastered public appearances. He mastered the media in two places, debates and Twitter. And he fought his fight not in the party. He fought it in media. And he, through media, he gained votes that he would not have been able to gain using the traditional political operations of a ground game or something like that. He had no ground game. He had very few activists on the ground. He had rallies, he had debate coverage, and he had his Twitter feed, which in turn generated a great deal of other news coverage. That was enough to get votes, and votes were enough to get him on the ticket. But I think your larger point, which is very well taken, is that Trump is, if you regard him as I do, as a sort of American fascist. The basis of his power is different than Hitler's or Mussolini's was, where it's differently configured. Like them, he requires or solicits a cult of personality. But unlike them, he doesn't need to build a party around himself or attack with force to come to power. On the contrary, in America at the moment, it is apparently sufficient to project your personality through media means and then thereby come to control of an entire political party. If he were to come to control of a state apparatus, my great terror is that the state apparatchiks would behave normally, the military would obey the president, the police would obey the president, and the next thing you know, we're in a place that looks a lot like Europe 50 years ago.
Excusez-moi, j'ai assez peu compris, excusez-moi, vos exposés en anglais, mais j'ai quand même capté, enfin j'ai cru comprendre que dans le passé, il y avait déjà eu des phénomènes, disons, qu'on peut dire fascistes ou fascisants, enfin de ce type, aux États-Unis. Mais est-ce qu'on pourrait dire aujourd'hui, enfin peut-être que vous l'avez dit, mais... Allô ? Oui, j'ai peut-être pas compris. Mais est-ce qu'on peut dire qu'aujourd'hui, bon, les problèmes qui peuvent expliquer le phénomène Donald Trump, bon, que vous avez expliqué, existaient déjà avant, qu'il n'y a rien de très nouveau finalement, mais dans le phénomène social en tant que tel, mais que cette montée en puissance possible de Donald Trump s'est passée par un phénomène nouveau qui n'existait pas, enfin quelque chose de nouveau qui n'existait pas avant, qui était une médiatisation, mais par autre chose que les médias institutionnels qui sont, il me semble, enfin CBS et autres, il me semble qu'ils sont plutôt quand même, enfin, ils sont pas du côté de Donald Trump, mais c'est passé par autre chose, par Internet, les réseaux sociaux, etc., mais qu'au fond, les problèmes de fond, disons, sont un peu les mêmes qu'avant, quoi, enfin que dans le passé.
Passer le micro à Fred Turner, mais avant ça, parce qu'on a parlé un peu... On en a parlé un peu ensemble. D'une part, je pense qu'il insistera pour dire que les causes médiatiques du phénomène Trump sont loin d'être les seules, mais que si elles existent, elles sont plutôt à rechercher du côté d'une sorte d'alliage entre des logiques médiatiques anciennes, et Trump est d'abord et avant tout un héros de la télé-réalité. Pendant 10 ans, il a habité dans les cuisines de millions d'Américains, et sa notoriété est d'abord... Ça, on a peut-être en France tendance à ne pas véritablement le prendre en compte. On le perçoit d'abord et avant tout comme un milliardaire, comme un homme d'affaires. Mais pour la plupart des électeurs américains, il est l'Ohana. Enfin, je veux dire, il est... non, mais sérieusement, c'est-à-dire que c'est vraiment quelqu'un dont la notoriété est de cette nature. Et elle est très puissante. Et donc, l'alliage dont je parlais, c'est cet alliage entre cette notoriété médiatique classique qui passe par les chaînes de télévision avec une autre forme de notoriété et de puissance médiatique qui passe par les réseaux sociaux aujourd'hui, en particulier par Twitter. Mais peut-être Fred va...
I think you covered it. I don't know that I have anything to add. I only followed that a little bit and I couldn't track the question. I'm sorry about that. I think you covered it. Does it need more? No, I'm good. Thank you.
My question is in the same style to Mr. Turner or Becker. Becker, you recall the two-step flow in the media studio of the 50s. When you have a big collective representation and you make case study, deep study, the group dynamic could move between the leader of opinion, between family and friendly, could move the dominant opinion. It was an argument for collective group dynamic at the concrete and grounded level. And you, Fred Turner, you suggest this dynamic has been neutralized by the new media system, the way the new diversified had been incorporated in the new media by big simple figure. So the campaign was a challenge between two stereotypes of representation, self-made man and middle-class family. But the methodological question is for Baker and Turner, the way two-step flow is neutralized. Because in the Obama campaign, there was group dynamic, not door-to-door knocking, with the student moving to social media and making crowdfunding. But there was a grounding campaign. In the campaign today, you say nothing for Trump, I don't know, for Hillary Clinton, it's much more media system. So the pattern of the 50 two-step flow is neutralized in the new media system. Facebook argue you have good dynamic inside virtualization, but the post-Brexit analysis say in the individual media, you go to the media, you confirm your opinion. You don't go to the opposite opinion. So your opinion is preformed. Your opinion is not in dynamic by interaction, struggling daily life, you see. So there's a change in the methodology of political practice between the Obama system and the system we have now, you see.
Well, I think we are inventing a lot of what is presented as fact about the way people experience the so-called social media. I'm thinking of the research that's been done and is being done by Dominique Pasquier, who wrote a book some of you may know about the television program Hélène et ses garçons. She did something really simple, which was she went to watch that émission with people and found that they often watched in groups, many people except friends, especially family, and there was a running commentary on the program. And it was not at all the world of isolated people interacting with a television set, but it was rather not necessarily opinion leaders. I mean, I didn't mean to suggest that we had to adopt the thing that that Lazarsfeld described, that we would always find that. Maybe it's not opinion leaders. Maybe it's people in a bar talking together. Maybe it's people in a barber shop. There are many places where people who don't know each other well still trade ideas, trade feelings, etc. And I think that's very important, and it's hard to study, you know, because it happens and it's gone. But if you're watching, you see it. You have to look in the places where it happens. I mean, I spent years working in bars, you know, playing the piano. And I saw what people were not there alone, you know, dealing with their private troubles, drinking or listening to our music. In fact, they, as far as we could tell, they didn't listen at all. And we preferred it that way. But they're doing things together there. There's a collective mood, and it's not some kind of magic. It's people talking to each other, turning to this man who I don't know, but he's sitting in the next stool in the bar. And I say to him, "What did you think of that? What kind of a nut is that guy?" Like that. I mean, that's one of the ways that public opinion gets formed. There are all kinds of places where people who don't know each other well nevertheless engage in meaningful collective activity. A very important example is a colleague of Fred's at Stanford, Mark Granovetter, made this wonderful finding years ago, and it really was a finding. He didn't expect. He wasn't looking for it. He didn't create an instrument to find it. Just ask people, how did you get the job you have now? How did you do that? And I don't know, he didn't know what he expected to find. But what he found was something that he labeled the strength of weak ties. That is, if I ask, if I need a job and I ask my close friends and my family, I already know almost everything they know because I know their lives, I know where they work, I know what they do. So they can't help me much. But if I meet somebody who is the cousin of a friend of mine who happens to be visiting, he says, oh, you're looking for a job doing, what do? You do that? I have a friend who's looking for somebody just like you. It turned out that a very large number of people found the position they had that way. So we can't decide in advance what constitutes a meaningful social tie that will have effects on our lives. You have to find that out. That's why Fred says, quite correctly, that he doesn't know, he can't go out and look for that. You can't go out and look for that. You can only go out and look and find it. Be alert and see it when it happens.
I would agree that with everything that Howie just said, but I would add one other piece. I wouldn't mistake the world of interactions on social media for the social world. It's not the social world, and that's a very important distinction. However, I think you can demonstrate that messages promoted on Twitter very quickly generate news stories on mainstream news outlets for profit, which in turn generate conversations on Facebook. That's pretty clearly documented. And I think what we see there is an acceleration of the circulation of stories and an ability for determined actors like Donald Trump to manipulate that accelerating ecology. I think it would be much harder to do in another kind of country. You know, we have a commercial media system that's extraordinarily profit-driven. I'm trying to imagine the BBC picking up on Donald Trump's tweets, right? They might. They do it really nicely. Like, and Donald Trump says, you know, can you imagine it? You know, Donald Trump hates women. Oh, Donald Trump. Ugh, God. Anyhow, you see my point, that we do live in an accelerating world. I don't think the research is in yet on what the impact of that work is. I disagree with Howie, I think, on one thing, and it's that on the commonness of places where we talk and do things together. I think that we live in the States in a place where it's getting more and more difficult to find places where meaningful interactions take place persistently over time. That last point is important, because it's persistence over time that gives you the community institutions that let you work problems out. Schools, elementary schools are a place where that happens. Some churches are a place where that happens. But once you stop having kids and if you're not religious, it can be very hard to enter into those spaces.
It ain't that simple. I mean, there's every level of kinds of interactions, and you have to be sensitive to them when they happen. And it's not, you know, it's not either or. I don't know.
Allez-y, vous avez le micro.
You have to go and go and look.
Okay. Allez-y.
Wait. So I'm an American in France who voted, of course, against Trump. That being said, I'm from rural South Carolina, so most people in my family and my friends from that area are Trump voters. And I'd like to address the conspiracy theory point. I think that point was not taken seriously, and it really should be taken seriously. I think the best way to take it seriously is actually look at the rather unusual role that WikiLeaks has played in this U.S. election. So it's true the U.S. is ran by conspiracy theories. Hillary is controlled by the Saudis, killed Vince Foster. Trump is controlled by Putin. The aliens, blah, blah. This is very common in the United States. Okay, let's not pretend it's not. That being said, if you look at WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks said in a very good essay called Government and Terrorist Conspiracies by Assange. He wrote it down. He said that our people are full of conspiracies, but the real conspiracy is obvious, that the governments of the world and the corporations are talking to each other, and that they have a large amount of control, and that those communications are inherently invisible. The Podesta emails, just like the State Department cable releases, are inherently very boring. Very little of any interest or any scandal was produced by the WikiLeaks revelations. They were very stupid revelations on some level. That being said, I think what was revealed to some extent by this election is that the hypothesis of Assange is not incorrect. That people themselves in the United States, a lot of dumb people, do believe the government does not operate in their interest at all. And that may not be so dumb. In fact, that may be correct. And you see that from the left in Spain, Podemos, Pirate Party, Iceland, in France, Le Pen. And these people are dumb, it's true, but then the future doesn't have them as part of it. The future is smart cities, vegetarians, people listening to nice music. It doesn't have a place for dumb people. And the left in France and the left in the United States, unlike the left in Spain, unlike the left in Iceland, has not addressed this. The voters for Le Pen come from predominantly former socialist areas. The voters, right, for Trump, many of them working class areas in the United States. This is very dangerous, and these are people who historically would vote left-wing. Now, due to the destruction of anything resembling coherent left-wing politics in France, in the United States, and other places, I think they vote for Trump. And because the conspiracy they've discovered is obvious and it's true. And so this is a problem, and I would like to know what the left can do about it.
I don't know that I can offer a short answer to your question. There was a study published by the website 538 in, I think, at the end of the spring, which was a study of the people who voted for Trump during the primaries, and that their average income was $72,000 a year, which put them above average income in the U.S. and also above the average income of people who voted for Clinton in the primaries. There are people who support Trump who are not working class, in fact. And even the definition of working class in the U.S., I'll talk about it later, maybe needs, I guess, some explanation. However, it is true that a part of the American electorate for several decades has defected from the Democrats and supported Republican candidates who were not fascists, Nixon, Reagan, Clinton, who turned out to be a neoliberal president. These were called Reagan Democrats in the 1980s. They were at Macomb County, for example. So there has been a pattern of conservative white working class voters. Trump did not, invent this group. He did not help this group emerge on the political scene, but he certainly took advantage of, yes, possibilities offered by the media, and also victims of the crisis, the economic crisis, to me very clearly. But we can track this electorate, going back all the way to, for example, to George Wallace in the 1960s. So that's just a provisional answer.
Oui, donc bonsoir. En fait, je vais poser ma question en français. Je suis là. parce que la prononciation en anglais, ce serait une catastrophe. Donc, voilà. En fait, ma question, justement, pour rebondir un peu sur cette question d'un vote de personnes peut-être moins... C'est la question, en fait, de la mondialisation. J'ai l'impression, je peux me tromper, que cet enjeu de la mondialisation a un peu polarisé le positionnement entre Clinton et Trump, notamment avec le fait que Clinton, elle, est plutôt pour les accords de libre-échange, etc., a un positionnement clairement plutôt favorable. Et je me demandais si Trump, justement, n'était pas perçu comme un candidat qui s'oppose à cette vision-là et qui défend Bon, c'est son slogan en même temps, Make America Great Again. Donc, j'ai l'impression que ça joue beaucoup aussi dans le succès de Trump. Oui, oui, que c'est vraiment lié à des positionnements très américains. Voilà, cette espèce d'isolement, d'isolationnisme.
Again, I'm very sorry not to speak French. I am embarrassed, but I'll try to take a stab at it as the question as I understand it. Globalization is a powerful force, but I think it plays out differently on different parts of the ground of the United States. And I think my colleague's comment on the crisis is well taken. It's not entirely clear what's driving the rise of inequality in the United States. Is it the outsourcing of jobs? Is it the collapse of mechanical industry? Is it the crisis of 2008 and the kind of poverty that's resulted in different regions? What is clear is that there is a dramatic divide emerging in the country and that the middle class is getting quite a bit smaller. And as that happens, I would argue that there is a distinct cultural style associated with the emerging classes. The elite style, which I share, is relatively cosmopolitan. It is exactly what you described, I think. The ideal world that we will create is a world of traveling vegetarians. And we'll be peace-loving and warm and interconnected and chatting with one another, and things will get better. I'm not working class and never have been, but the times I've spent in that world looks very different. It's a very different world. How do cultural styles of honor, of consistency across generations, of family work in a world where none of those things seem to bring you power? What do you do when the institutions that are your training ground, right, the high school, the football field, the factory where your father worked, the farm where your father worked, are no longer available as training sites? How do you become a valued and valuable person? How do you assert your value when the world you grow up in doesn't speak the language of the dominant elites? And I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that's a globalization story. I think it's a cultural one, but I confess to a bad habit of trying to explain most everything culturally.
Just a quick remark, but she's very qualified, but she's not a leftist.
She's not a nice person. She's not a leftist. Explain to me what a leftist is.
Well, her economic program leaves much to be desired. If you want a word that is, more fair in terms of relationships between the classes, in terms of the experience of work, in terms of access to health care, you name it.
Well, she's certainly not a leftist in the sense that Bernie Sanders is, but she's more of a realist. Sanders was an ideologue of the left because everything that he stood for was impossible to accomplish.
Peut-être une dernière question et puis après on change de, on donne enfin la parole à Sandra et...
Enfin. Just one quick question about the campaign, and I just wanted to have your take about. I was struck. I went through the three debates and some other moments, which was painful, and I was struck by the almost complete. We talk about trade fast, but I was struck by the almost complete lack of content in the dialogue and the debates. And I remember 2000 and 2004 and 2008. And at least there were some issues being discussed. And I remember how scornful we were here about George W. Bush being a stupid and so on. But Bush, compared to Trump, looked as an intellectual now. So I wonder if you think that it's the result of TV, of social media, or there is something else that voters don't want even to hear about issues anymore. I want to know about that, please.
Well, I will shamelessly speculate, okay? But it's pure speculation, and I just want to say that up front, and I know that. I have two intuitions. One intuition is about Donald Trump and his Goebbels campaign. I mean, Donald Trump has followed a classic advertising campaign like Goebbels that repeated a negative message over and over and over, and like a bully on the playground, sort of said, believe me, believe me, believe me, believe me, and for whatever reason, people have done that. I have a deeper fear. I want to hear from them in a sec. I have a deeper fear, and this is an intuition, but it is a real one and a fearful one, that America is a world in which the media are so ubiquitous and so heavily commercialized that the commercial motives of the actors involved are morphing our political discourse such that it's become almost impossible to have a reasoned discourse because that's not sufficiently profitable. And instead, we've actually shifted our public debate into the realm of animal instinct. Oh, he's so big. Oh, she's so mean. Oh, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's like worldwide wrestling, the government.
Il faudrait ajouter à ça, puisque la question était posée, j'entendais ce matin à la radio, de savoir si la critique par les élites médiatiques de Trump n'a pas produit des effets pervers en contre Trump. Moi, je veux bien qu'on se pose ce genre de questions. C'est pas facile de mesurer les effets, mais avant de se poser ce genre de questions, il y a peut-être un certain nombre de faits, en revanche, qu'on peut noter, notamment le fait qu'un article sur Donald Trump, quel que soit le contenu de cet article, qu'il soit positif ou négatif, qu'il soit long, qu'il soit court, peu importe, un article sur Trump sur le web aux États-Unis rapporte 20 fois plus d'argent en publicité qu'un article sur Hillary Clinton. Et là, on a une question qui nous est posée et qui a trait à la nature des modèles économiques des médias. Et là où, en France, on entend le président de la République se plaindre sur le fait que, contrairement à la presse de droite, la presse de gauche n'est jamais suffisamment en soutien d'un gouvernement de gauche, je pense que ces questions sont totalement dépassées en termes de réflexion sur les effets des médias. Les effets beaucoup plus profonds ont trait au modèle économique. Et on peut, la question que je pose à propos de Trump, je pense qu'on peut très facilement la transporter en France.